So if you ask most people to visualize their organs, wait, I shouldn't say it like that. You ask them to just picture what's inside them.
Well, they tend to assign them these very rigid, singular identities, like cartoon versions of organs.
Exactly. Like the stomach is just a chemical vat.
Here.
And the heart is, you know, a mechanical pump.
Right.
And the lungs, well, we usually just relegate them to the role of basically passive biological meat balloons.
Meat balloons. That's incredibly accurate to how we think of them.
Right. You inhale, they expand. You exhale, they deflate. It is a very comfortable, straightforward visual.
It is, but it's also, frankly, a massive disservice to what is objectively one of the most dynamic, heavily trafficked intersections in human biology.
Yeah.
Because treating the lungs merely as, like, air sacs, it completely ignores about 90% of their actual job description.
Which is exactly why we are tearing up that textbook definition today.
So
welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive into your own chest cavity.
We've gathered a really comprehensive stack of source material dissecting the modern understanding of the human lung.
And our mission today is to completely reshape your relationship with every single breath you take. We are moving past the simple mechanics of inflation.
Yeah, we're looking at the hidden reality here. The fact that your lungs operate as covert chemical factories, vital blood reservoirs, and just absolute evolutionary marvels.
To do that, we are going to travel from the gross structural anatomy of the rib cage down into the microscopic border crossings of single cell walls.
And then eventually we'll zoom back out into the bizarre evolutionary pathways of, you know, spiders and crocodiles.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get down to the microscopic machinery, let's establish the physical real estate these organs actually command.
Right.
Ground us in the macro architecture inside the human chest.
Sure. So the first thing to understand is that your lungs absolutely dominate your thoracic cavity, but they are not identical twins.
No,
they are distinctly asymmetrical to accommodate the rest of the neighborhood. Your right lung is actually the larger and heavier of the two, and it's divided by fissures into three distinct lobes.
But the left side has a space constraint because of the heart, right?
Exactly.
So how does the left lung adapt to that structurally? Does it just squish out of the way?
It quite literally yields the space, yeah. The left lung only has two lobes, and along its inner border, it features a physical indentation.
Like a dent.
Yeah. It's known as the cardiac notch. It essentially acts as a protective cradle for the heart.
Oh, wow.
And to structurally compensate for that missing third lobe, the left lung actually has a small sort of tongue-like projection at its base. It's called the lingula.
The lingula. So they are totally custom fitted around the cardiovascular system.
They really are.
How much mass are we talking about for the whole package? Like, if you weighed them.
Together, they weigh around 1.3 kilograms.
So just shy of 3 pounds.
Right. But the mass is deceiving, you know, because they are incredibly porous. Within that 1.3 kilograms, you have an estimated 2,400 kilometers of branching airways.
Wait, 2,400 kilometers? That is like roughly 1,500 miles of tubing folded up behind my ribs.
It's hard to wrap your head around.
It's like taking the distance from New York to Miami and aggressively folding it into a space the size of a shoebox.
The geometry required to make that fit is staggering.
Mm.
And at the terminal end of all those microscopic branching tubes are the alveoli.
Those are the tiny air sacs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where oxygen actually enters your blood, you have somewhere between 300 and 500 million of them.
Which brings up a statistic I feel like everyone has heard at some point.
Oh, I knew where you're going with this.
The classic claim that if you spread your lungs out flat, they would cover an entire tennis court. Given the numbers you just dropped, does that actually hold up?
No, it's actually a deeply entrenched myth.
Wait, really?
Yeah, completely. I mean, the surface area of the lungs is immense, don't get me wrong. It's estimated to be between 50 and 75 square meters.
Okay.
But a standard singles tennis court is significantly larger than that. It's closer to 195 square meters.
Oh, wow.
So in reality, the surface area of your lungs is less than half of a tennis court.
Consider that myth busted. But honestly, 50 to 75 square meters of delicate tissue folded inside my chest is still a biological miracle.
Oh, absolutely.
It's essentially microscopic origami. But if we follow the logic of that massive surface area,
yeah,
every time you take a breath, you are exposing 50 square meters of highly sensitive wet tissue to whatever is in the atmosphere.
Right.
How does an area that large not become immediately clogged with atmospheric dust, pollen, and bacteria?
Well, it survives because it operates an aggressive, fully automated self-cleaning mechanism.
Okay.
Because the sheer volume of incoming debris means your lungs can't just filter the air. They have to physically transport the garbage out.
Right, like an active disposal system.
Exactly. And this relies on a process called mucociliary clearance.
Mucociliary clearance.
Yeah.
So that implies mucus and cilia. How do they coordinate?
Think of the lining of your upper airways as a microscopic upward-moving conveyor belt.
Okay, I'm picturing it. The foundational layer consists of goblet cells. They're aptly named because they look like little chalices, and they continuously secrete mucus.
And that mucus acts as what, a trap?
Yes, a highly effective sticky trap. It catches pathogens and particulate matter the very moment they land.
But I mean, a sticky trap is totally useless if you just leave it there to rot. The dirt needs an exit strategy.
Exactly, and that is where the ciliated cells step in. Interspersed among all those goblet cells are cells featuring hundreds of tiny hair-like projections, the cilia.
Right, the hairs.
And they don't just wave around randomly. They beat in a highly coordinated, rhythmic, upward stroke.
Upward against gravity.
Yes, they literally sweep the contaminated mucus up your respiratory tract toward your pharynx.
And then what happens?
Well, you either swallow it harmlessly into your stomach acid, which destroys the bacteria, or you cough it out.
Wow. A self-cleaning escalator. That makes perfect sense for the tubes. But what happens when we get down to the alveoli? Those 500 million air sacs? You can't have mucus down there, or you wouldn't be able to absorb oxygen through it, would you?
You've hit on the central engineering paradox of the lung right there. The alveoli must remain pristine and dry enough for gas to pass through.
So the escalator stops.
The escalator system stops entirely before it reaches them. The alveolar walls themselves are incredibly thin.
How thin?
Super thin. 95% of that surface area is made up of type I cells, which are flattened squamous cells. They basically act as ultra-thin glass windows to allow oxygen to slide directly into your bloodstream.
Okay, so if type I cells take up 95% of the space, what is happening in the remaining 5%?
That 5% is occupied by type 2 cells, and honestly, they are arguably the unsung heroes of your chest.
Really? Why?
Well, they're cube-shaped, and they typically cluster in the corners of the alveolar. Their primary function is to secrete a substance called lung surfactant.
Surfactant? What does that do?
Without surfactant, the natural surface tension of the microscopic layer of water in your lungs would act like a wet plastic bag.
Oh, meaning it would just stick to itself.
Exactly. The moment you exhaled, the walls of the alveoli would stick together and collapse permanently.
So they are constantly producing a biological anti-stick coating?
They are. But their secondary function is even more remarkable.
Tell me.
Because type I cells are so incredibly thin and specialized, they've actually lost the ability to divide and reproduce.
Wait, so they can't repair themselves?
No, they can't. If a type I cell is damaged, a type II cell will literally differentiate it, shapeshifts into a type I cell to patch the hole in the wall.
Are you kidding? So they act as an embedded stem cell repair crew, just fixing the windows on the fly.
Pretty much. But that still doesn't solve the debris problem you mentioned earlier.
Right, because if there's no mucus escalator down there and a stray piece of dust bypasses the upper airways, what removes it?
The immune system dispatches a specialized cleanup crew called alveolar macrophages.
Macrophages?
Yeah, you can visualize them as independent sweepers or like little Pac-Men patrolling the air sacs.
Raw.
If they encounter a stray bacterium, a piece of dust, or even a red blood cell that accidentally leaked from a capillary, the macrophage just envelops and digests it.
That's amazing.
Add to that a protein called elastin, which gives the alveolar walls their rubber band-like recoil, and these tiny interconnecting escape hatches between the sacs called the pores of cone, and you have a highly resilient, dynamic microenvironment.
Resilient, yes, but obviously not invincible.
No, definitely not.
Because if we look at the lifestyle choices people make, we're introducing some severe chemical stressors to this micro world every day.
Very true.
Mechanically speaking, how does something like, say, chronic alcohol consumption compromise that system?
Well, alcohol essentially paralyzes your defense mechanism.
It paralyzes them.
Chronic exposure to alcohol actively desensitizes the cilia. It alters the way the proteins function inside those hair-like structures, which physically slows down the upward beating of the escalator.
Oh, wow. So the escalator just grinds to a halt.
Exactly. And when the mucus stagnates, bacteria are allowed to sit and multiply inside the warm, wet environment of the lungs.
That sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It is. That stagnation is the direct mechanism behind why chronic alcohol use drastically increases the risk of severe pneumonia.
the escalator breaks down and the garbage piles up. But what about smoking?
Ah, smoking.
If the lungs are so adaptable, you know, with these shape-shifting cells and macrophage Pac-Man, why is cigarette smoke able to cause such permanent structural devastation?
Because smoking doesn't just overwhelm the filters. It actively hacks the immune response and turns your own enzymes against you.
Turns them against you.
Yeah. The chemical stress of the smoke deranges the basal cells, preventing normal repair. But critically, it triggers widespread inflammation.
Okay.
Your immune cells flood the area and release an enzyme called elastase.
Let me guess. Elastase is designed to break down elastin.
Correct. And remember, elastin is what keeps your alveoli tight and bouncy. When elastase floods the tissue, it literally digests the structural framework of your lungs.
Oh my God.
The walls separating those 500 million tiny bubbles just dissolved. They fuse together into these large, floppy, inefficient, empty cavities that cannot push air back out.
So you lose the surface area and the elasticity simultaneously.
Yes. And that structural collapse is the fundamental definition of emphysema.
That is just a terrifying chain reaction. You are basically provoking your immune system into eating your own structural framework.
Exactly.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because in the source material, there's a fundamental shift in how we categorize the lung.
Yes, there is.
We have to look at the exact border where the air stops and the blood begins.
Yeah.
Because it turns out the lung is running a massive secondary operation that has absolutely nothing to do with breathing.
It is, and it fundamentally changes how we view the organ. Your lungs are so deeply entangled with your cardiovascular system that they function as a highly active metabolic and endocrine hub. To start with, your lungs require a unique dual blood supply.
Wait, why do they need two separate blood supplies?
Well, you have the pulmonary circulation, which is the massive volume of deoxygenated blood arriving from the right side of your heart.
That's the blood that needs oxygen.
Exactly. The lungs' job is to process that blood, fill it with oxygen, and send it back. But the physical tissue of the lung itself, the bronchi, the supporting structures, they can't survive on that deoxygenated blood.
Oh, of course. They need oxygen too.
Right. So the body routes a completely separate system, the bronchial circulation, directly from the aorta. It delivers freshly oxygenated blood to feed the lung tissue itself.
It's like a massive industrial processing plant getting its own private catering line so the workers don't starve while they process the main product.
That is an excellent analogy. But, you know, their relationship with the blood goes well beyond just processing and consuming.
How so?
The lungs actually act as a strategic blood reservoir for the entire body.
A reservoir?
Yes. At any given moment, approximately 450 milliliters of blood, nearly 9% of your total blood volume, is just pooling in the highly compliant vessels of your chest.
Wait, why hoard 9% of the blood supply? If I'm running or exercising, wouldn't I want that circulating?
You hoard it for emergencies. The pulmonary vessels are incredibly flexible. If you suffer a severe hemorrhage, like a trauma where your systemic blood pressure drops dangerously low, your pulmonary blood vessels will automatically constrict.
Yeah.
This action forcibly shifts that stored 450 milliliters out of the lungs and straight into your systemic circulation.
Wow.
It is an automated biological failsafe to keep your brain and vital organs perfused with blood when you're bleeding out.
So they are quite literally a physiological blood bank. That alone changes my perspective completely.
Yeah, no, right?
But the source material also mentions blood pressure regulation. How does an air sac control blood pressure?
Through chemical synthesis. The endothelial cells lining the blood vessels within your lungs actually manufacture an enzyme called ACE, or angiotensin-converting enzyme.
ACE, right? I've heard of ACE inhibitors for blood pressure.
Exactly. This plays a pivotal role in the renin-angiotensin system. When your body detects that your blood pressure is too low, it releases a mild precursor called angiotensin I.
Okay.
As that blood flows through your lungs, ACE instantly converts it into angiotensin II, which is a potent vasoconstrictor.
Meaning it tightens the blood vessels?
Yes. It causes your blood vessels to clamp down, driving your blood pressure back up to safe levels.
So the lungs are manufacturing the chemical wrench that tightens the plumbing.
Exactly. And the systemic influence doesn't stop there either.
What else is there?
Well, recent studies confirm that the lungs are a Meiji site of platelet production.
Platelets. Like for blood clotting.
Yeah. Megakaryocytes, these giant cells that create blood platelets, actually migrate from the bone marrow to the lungs. And the physical environment of the pulmonary capillary bed literally helps shear them apart to release platelets into your blood.
So we've got a platelet factory, a blood bank, and a blood pressure regulator.
All hidden in your chest. And we haven't even touched on the nervous system interface yet.
There's a nervous system interface?
Oh, yeah. Scattered throughout the lining of your airways are pulmonary neuroendocrine cells.
Okay, what do they do?
These specialized cells extend tiny sensors into the airway lumen to monitor the chemical composition of the air you inhale.
Like tasting the air.
Literally. If they detect dropping oxygen levels or certain irritants, they don't just signal the brain. They actively produce and secrete neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine directly into the surrounding tissue.
Wait, they are dosing the body with serotonin based on the air quality. Why would they do that?
Because serotonin acts locally to constrict or dilate the pulmonary blood vessels and the airway smooth muscle.
Oh, I see.
It's a way for the lung to internally optimize where the blood and air are flowing, matching the perfusion of blood to the specific areas getting the best ventilation. Your lungs are actively tasting the air and adjusting your internal plumbing in real time.
That shatters the meat balloon visual entirely. It is a highly sensitive, autonomous manufacturing plant.
It really is.
But, you know, seeing how unbelievably complex and specialized the human lung is, it begs the question of evolution.
Yeah, how did we get here?
Exactly. How did nature arrive at this specific solution? Did other branches of the animal kingdom solve the breathing problem differently?
They absolutely did. And the evolutionary history of the lung is full of just wild divergences.
Okay, give me some examples.
Well, the most common misconception is that human lungs evolved from fish gills. Like a fish crawled onto land and its gills simply internalized.
Right, that's definitely what I pictured.
It's entirely false. Gills and lungs are completely separate evolutionary tracks.
If not from gills, where did the blueprints for lungs come from?
Vertebrate lungs are actually homologous to the gas bladders of fish.
Gas bladders.
Yeah. Millions of years ago, certain ancient bony fish living in stagnant, oxygen-poor water developed simple outpocketings of their esophagus.
Just little pouches.
Right. When the water couldn't provide enough oxygen, they would swim to the surface and gulp atmospheric air into these simple sacs to survive.
Wow.
Over millions of years, those tiny digestive pouches evolved into the complex respiratory systems of land-dwelling tetrapods.
So we are essentially breathing through highly modified fish swim bladders.
In terms of their evolutionary origin, yes. But the mechanics of how animals inflate those bladders vary wildly across the animal kingdom. Take birds, for instance.
How do birds breathe?
Well, humans use a bellows system. Air goes in, stops, and goes back out the exact same way. It is inherently inefficient because the old air mixes with the new air.
Right, dead space.
Exactly. But birds, however, require massive amounts of oxygen to sustain flight, so they evolved circulatory lungs.
Circulatory. How do you circulate air without breathing it back out the same way?
It relies on an intricate supply chain of air sacs extending deep into their abdomen and even into their hollow bones.
Into their bones. That's wild.
Yeah. When a bird inhales, the fresh air bypasses the lungs and fills the posterior air sacs. When they exhale, that fresh air is pushed forward into the lungs across tiny parallel tubes called parabronchi.
Okay, I'm following.
Then the next inhale pushes that air into anterior sacs, and the next exhale pushes it out of the body. The mechanical result is continuous unidirectional airflow.
That's incredible.
The lungs are bathed in fresh oxygen on both the inhale and the exhale.
It's like replacing a hand bellows with a continuous jet engine.
Yeah.
It is brilliant. What about reptiles? They don't have the metabolic demands of flight, but their anatomy presents some unique challenges.
Reptiles provide some of the most fascinating biomechanical workarounds. Consider a turtle.
Okay.
Its ribs are permanently fused to its shell. They literally cannot expand their chest to draw a breath.
Oh, I never thought of that. How do they breathe?
To circumvent this, turtles utilize the muscles of their forelimbs and their pectoral girdle to physically compress and expand their lungs.
Wait, they are pumping their arms to push the air out?
Yes, exactly.
That is incredibly resourceful. And I read in the source material about crocodiles using something called a hepatic piston.
Yes, the hepatic piston.
Please explain the physics of a hepatic piston to me because it sounds crazy.
It is as aggressive as it sounds.
Mm.
So crocodilians possess a muscle anchored to their pelvic bone that extends all the way up to attach to their massive liver.
To their liver.
Yes. When a crocodile wants to inhale, it contracts that muscle, violently yanking the liver backward toward its tail.
No way. They are literally using their liver as an internal plunger.
Exactly. Pulling the massive organ backward drastically increases the volume of the chest cavity, which creates a vacuum that pulls air in.
Wow.
Conversely, amphibians like frogs don't use vacuums at all. They rely on positive pressure through a mechanism called buccal pumping.
Buccal pumping.
Yeah, a frog lowers the floor of its mouth to suck air in, closes its nostrils, and physically swallows the air, using its throat muscles to forcefully shove the air down into its lungs.
Literally swallowing air like food.
Yep.
And if we look outside of vertebrates entirely, to invertebrates, I know bugs don't have a chest cavity or a diaphragm.
Right. Invertebrates arrived at entirely different respiratory solutions through convergent evolution. Many arachnids, like spiders and scorpions, utilize book lungs.
Book lungs.
These are delicate stacks of alternating air pockets and tissue filled with hemolymph, which is the equivalent of spider blood. They are arranged exactly like the folded pages of a book, maximizing surface area for gas diffusion straight from the atmosphere.
Nature really just reinvents the wheel over and over.
Oh, for sure. And perhaps the most bizarre example is the giant terrestrial coconut crab.
The ones that look like heavily armored trash cans.
Yes, those. They employ bronchostical lungs. Coconut crabs begin their life cycle in the ocean as larvae, breathing underwater. But as they mature and move on to land, they develop these terrestrial lungs. Their gills atrophy to the point of being vestigial. The transformation is so complete that if you submerge an adult coconut crab in the ocean, it will drown.
Wait, a crab that drowns?
It is a crab that has completely lost the ability to breathe water.
An ocean creature that will drown in the ocean. It is amazing how highly specialized respiration can become. So, to bring it back to you, the listener, how does our human system compare?
Good question.
If we aren't swallowing air like frogs, and we certainly aren't using our livers as plungers, what is the exact physics of a human breath?
Human breathing is dictated by Boyle's law, which states that in a closed system, pressure and volume are inversely proportional.
Okay, physics 101.
Right. Beneath your lungs sits the diaphragm, a massive dome-shaped sheet of muscle. When you decide to inhale, your diaphragm flexes, pulling downward and flattening out.
And your ribs move too, right?
Yes. Simultaneously, your intercostal muscles pull your ribcage up and out. This instantly expands the physical volume of your thoracic cavity.
And according to Boyle's law, expanding the volume drops the pressure.
Precisely. The pressure inside your chest drops below the atmospheric pressure surrounding your body. You don't actually pull the air in. You create an internal vacuum. And the weight of the Earth's atmosphere physically rushes in to equalize the pressure.
You create the void, and the atmosphere fills
it. Oh, exactly.
So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive looking to dismantle the idea of the passive meat balloon.
And I think we did.
Definitely. We busted the tennis court myth, scaling it back to 50 square meters of highly protected microscopic origami. We explored the mechanics of shape-shifting type 2 cells and macrophage Pac-Men defending the walls.
Yeah.
We uncovered a secondary life where the lungs function as an emergency blood bank, a platelet factory, and a chemical regulatory system sensing oxygen and dosing serotonin.
Right.
And we looked across the animal kingdom at birds with continuous jet engine lungs, crocodiles using their livers as plungers, and spiders breathing through biological books. It is a staggering network of complexity hidden right behind your ribs.
It truly is. And yet, for all that complexity, I think the most profound piece of the source material is the sheer vulnerability of how that system begins.
What do you mean?
Well, because right now, for anyone listening, your lungs feel like a permanent fixed engine. You breathe in, you breathe out, it's automatic. But before you were born, they were completely dormant.
Right, because a fetus doesn't breathe air.
They don't. Before birth, your lungs were entirely filled with fetal lung fluid. And they were wildly underdeveloped. You possessed only about 1/6 of the alveoli that you have right now.
So you barely had any of the air sac.
Exactly. Your mother's blood provided all your oxygen while your lungs simply waited.
So you are floating in fluid with lungs that aren't even fully built yet.
Yeah.
How do you make the transition from a water-dwelling organism to an air-breathing one without suffocating?
It is triggered by a shock to the system.
Mm.
The moment you were born, the sudden jarring drop in temperature from the womb to the delivery room hits your skin.
Just the cold air.
The cold air. That thermal shock sends a massive alarm signal to your central nervous system. Your brain panics and forces your diaphragm to violently contract for the very first time. You take a desperate gasp.
Wow.
In roughly 10 seconds, the pressure dynamics in your lungs radically shift. The fetal fluid is rapidly absorbed into the surrounding tissue or exhaled.
In 10 seconds.
Just 10 seconds. The blood vessels in the lungs dilate, blood rushes in to meet the air, and the lifelong rhythm of gas exchange officially begins.
A 10-second window to completely change how you survive in the world.
And the most incredible part is that because you only had a fraction of your alveoli at that moment, you physically grew the vast majority of your lung capacity after you were already born.
That's insane.
You built the microscopic origami while you were actively using it to stay alive.
Think about that. The next time you find yourself dizzy from standing up too fast or catching your breath after a run, remember that you are not just inflating a pair of balloons. You are operating a custom-built, shape-shifting chemical refinery that you spent your entire childhood growing.
And it all started with a single shocked gasp in a cold room. Take a deep breath, appreciate the machinery. And we'll see you on the next deep dive.